for the week of May 18th, 2014. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 236, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Cannes, France, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And not in France, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're in New York City, though, so that's...
I'm not bitter at all.
You're not jealous.
No, I'm not jealous.
Well, if you were jealous, maybe they could make a movie out of your life, and it would be here at the Cannes Film Festival.
Are you saying our relationship is much like that between Steve Carell and Channing Tatum in Foxcatcher, which you just saw this morning?
I would not say that I'm not a wealthy millionaire, and I'm not going to say how that film ends. So, I mean, you know, Michael, because you happen to,
it's based on a true story.
But I'm not going to get into detail on the plot on that one.
But that's one of the films at Cannes, which we'll be talking about this week. Of course, I assume it's a good-looking film.
Yes, it was shot very, very well. Yes.
And of course, this weekend, just a day or two ago, we heard that cinematographer Gordon Willis is dead. It's our weekly obit section of the show.
Which for some reason, I don't know why, we are now traditionally opening the show by talking about obituaries, which is why the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times and most major newspapers place them on the front page.
They've started now following our lead. That's right.
Well,
it's a chance to celebrate his career. He's one of the great cinematographers of all time. He defined the 1970s, which is, according to some people, the greatest decade of film. He did the Godfather films. He did a lot of Woody Allen, including Annie Hall and Manhattan.
Yes.
He did all the President's Men and Clute. The list goes on and on, especially in the 70s. And my God, though, he must have been a pain in the neck to work with. Because, I mean, it's shocking, really. He didn't win an Oscar for his work in the 1970s. He never won an Oscar. He was ultimately given an honorary Oscar, but he wasn't even nominated for an Oscar until 1983 for Woody Allen's Zelig. I mean, he made movies that all won Oscars. They got like dozens and dozens of nominations. The Hollywood people had to run in the opposite direction not to give him a nomination. They really had to work hard. I mean,
I was a production assistant on The Godfather Part 3 for a day
God
or two.
God help you.
Yeah, well, and he, of course, shot that movie, right?
Yes.
And he, I just remember watching him, and he was sitting in his chair in between takes, sleeping, literally sleeping.
Well, he was kind of done then. He didn't work much in the 90s, a little bit, a fair amount, but you really feel like he did his work in the 70s, and then he kept working in the 80s, especially with Woody. He did some work in the 90s, and he just stopped. He seemed to lose interest in a way, and I always thought somebody might lure him back in for another job, but now he's gone. But, I mean, you look at what was nominated in 1972. That was the year that Cabaret won Best Cinematography, a fine choice, though obviously The Godfather was greater. But the other four nominees, when they didn't nominate The Godfather, which, of course, got every other nomination possible and won Best Picture, it wasn't like they ignored the film. The other four nominees for Best Cinematography were 1776, Butterflies Are Free, The Poseidon Adventure, and Travels with My Aunt, which, believe me, I've seen, it looks ghastly. And in 74, when he wasn't nominated for Godfather Part II, the Oscar went to The Towering Inferno.
Oh, my gosh.
So he must have really been a pain. This was a grumpy man who said, I hate Hollywood. They're all untalented hacks. God bless him. I love him. What a great talent. And you go see a movie. If it's got Gordon Willis's name on it, it's a good bet to be at least interesting.
Or at least shot very well.
Oh, certainly shot very well. And, of course, hopefully our show will be shot very well. I think it's lit in it's a Panavision. And I think it's this week is in black and white, I think.
Yes. Well, it's in 5.1 surround mono.
Okay. Well, that's the sound, right? The sound.
That's right. And
Gordon Willis has nothing to do with sound design.
I don't know how we got on that subject.
Well, you have to do with the design of the show. What are we going to be talking about this week?
Well, as you mentioned, we're going to be talking all about this year's Cannes Film Festival. We're halfway through the 12 days in May, during which the annual event is held here in the south of France. And we can tell you all about what films attendees are talking about and what the important stories are coming out of this year's festival. We're also going to be talking about the television upfronts. They were held last week in New York City, so now we all know which TV series we will or won't be watching next season. Inside Baseball is once again all about how we'll be watching those television shows in the future. More than likely, it's going to be from fewer providers, however. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We have the box office from around the world, including Cannes, even though you don't have to pay to see films when you're at the festival.
Oh, you pay. And, trust me. If you've seen the exchange rate between the dollar and the euro, you pay.
And the strikes. But anyway, the number one movie around the world, according to RentTrack, we have a link to their site in our show notes, is, of course, Godzilla. It made $200 million around the world. To be exact, it made $196,205,000, but it's darn close to $200 million. And I'm sure before this show goes off into the sunset, we will see a film debut worldwide to $300 or $400 million. It's only a matter of time.
I'd say it's a monster hit.
It is, and it got decent reviews, much better than The Amazing Spider-Man. 51% of the people who went to see the movie North America, I shouldn't say that. I'm sorry. 51% of the box office, I believe, is how it should be phrased, went to 3D ticket sales or large format ticket sales. So that's much better than we've seen recently. They broke the 50% mark again. So people wanted to see it, and they wanted the spectacle, and they paid extra to do it.
And that's exactly what Hollywood wants. I mean, I know that, Michael, you think that they all want 70%. They kind of know that on some of these films that they're not going to – it's going to be like an airline, that 30% will choose business class or first class, and then everybody else will choose economy.
Well, the reason most people choose business class is because they're not paying for it.
That's right.
So if I wasn't paying for it, actually, I would still choose 2D most of the time because it's usually a waste of time artistically and the glasses are a pain in the neck. That's certainly what some people felt about Amazing Spider-Man 2. That made another $50 million worldwide. It's at $633 million and counting. It seems to be falling a little fast, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely a bomb. Definitely, it's a huge money loser.
Well, it costs a lot to make. It costs $200 million, right?
I think so. Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, and probably $80 million, $90 million to market. I mean, it doesn't get much bigger to market than something like Godzilla or The Amazing Spider-Man. You're opening it up worldwide. It's in 93 markets. So there are about, I guess, maybe 100 markets in the world. You know, that's to say.
No, I think there's actually, I don't know exactly how many territories. It's not, you know, markets.
Territories, yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question, and I will be finding that out now that you've asked me. I mean, I'm not going to find it out right now while we're recording, but, you know, maybe.
You could.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah, so that's at $633 million. So it's just edging into profitability, I think, is probably safe to say.
Yes.
And it's going to make money. It's going to be fine. There will be an Amazing Spider-Man 3 and 4. They're doing spinoffs. But you look at this compared to the last Spidey franchise. Spider-Man 1 and 2 with Tobey Maguire had ecstatic reviews. People were demanding it be nominated for Best Picture. The reviews were great. The box office was great. And still, Sony would not leave them alone, mess with them, didn't let them make the third film they wanted to make, refused to let them make their fourth film, and kicked them off the project. So now they're back again. They've got another film. It's making good money, but the reviews are not good. And now they're trying to spin off all these prequels and sequels and villains and all that stuff.
You know what I think, Michael? What this movie and this franchise really needs? It needs a reboot.
At number three around the world is Neighbors, the Zac Efron, Seth Rogen film. It could be a game changer for Zac Efron, who's made some decent choices as far as small films. He's not really carried a lot of films as himself as an actor. He hasn't tried to pretty smartly. But here he is. He's a co-lead. It's a comedy. It's a dude film. It sort of wipes away his Goody Two Shoes musical, you know, theater background with the TV movie High School Musical. It made $40 million worldwide this weekend. It's at $150 million. It only cost $18 million to make. So it's going to gross well over 10 times its budget. That's always a good sign. And this is a really big moneymaker. They're probably trying to figure out if they can have – well, I know what they're going to do. You'll have a sorority move next to a new mom, right?
Yes.
You had the frat next to the guy. You got to have a sorority move next to mom. There you go. I've just made your sequel for you, Universal. You thank me later. At number four around the world is The Other Woman. Maybe that'll be the mom in the movie. Oh, that's a sad thing to say, isn't it? But Cameron Diaz stars in The Other Woman, $14 million worldwide. It's at $150 million and counting, just like Neighbors. Another solid hit for Diaz. Her movies have now grossed $5 billion worldwide.
That's with a B, right? $5 billion?
That's with a B.
Yeah, wow.
Now, of
okay.
course, she's got the Shrek franchise
okay.
and a couple other big movies, but she's made a lot of consistently successful movies. I thought, oh, gee, it's been a while since she had a hit. No, she's had hits pretty regularly throughout her career. Most recently was Bad Teacher. That made over $200 million. She's got a string of $200 million-plus movies, like comedies like this one and comedy dramas. You know, so she's really been a proven box office draw.
Well, you know, if you were to search for positive news with the word Rio in it right now, on the front page of the New York Times today was something about how, like, where they're having the Olympics in 2016, it's like they called it a latrine, okay?
Well, that's what they
said. But Rio 2, however, is making money.
Well, those stories are, of course, a mainstay for building up to Olympics. You know, you always got to have the story about how the country is struggling to finish the projects.
Right.
That almost always happens. Happened in Russia, and now it's happening in Rio. But the film, Rio 2, is doing well. $11 million worldwide, $440 million and counting.
Right.
And number six, opening in North America only. No, two territories. I'm not sure where else it opened up. Maybe India. But it's Million Dollar Arm. Another feature film starring John Hamm, who's trying to find life beyond Mad Men. Is this the one to do it? No, I don't think so. It made $11 million worldwide, mostly in North America, where it opened pretty softly, you know. But it only cost $25 million to make. So if it can get to $50 million worldwide, $60 million, they'll be okay.
You know, I saw the movie. It's actually, it's decent.
Yeah. Well, you know, then maybe they'll have a stronger life in home video and cable and all that and prove a valuable property.
Yeah, it's you know, I can't see.
But decent is not exactly, you know.
Yeah, no.
Sending people scurrying to the box office.
I agree. It's not going to do well in the UK where they don't even play baseball.
Well, but it has the cricket angle.
Good point. I take that back.
Okay. Yes. It is about a man who goes to India and stages a reality competition among cricketing pitchers to try and find somebody who can come back to America and be a pitcher in baseball. And it's based, of course, on a true story.
Yes.
Frozen will be based on a true story in about 300 years if this all keeps up. It's the Disney animated film, and by this I mean climate change. It grossed $7 million. It passed the $1.2 billion mark. I didn't think it would get there, but it did. Still chugging along worldwide. And number eight, Captain America, the Winter Soldier, that passed the $700 million mark. At number nine is a film opening up in South Korea. It's called Obsessed. It made just about $5 million, and it's about a guy in the military. It's a drama about a man who is married to the daughter of, like, his commanding officer, the head of the base, and wrongly, stupidly, foolishly, he gets bored with her and starts to have an affair with another woman who's the wife of another officer. That just can't turn out well.
Especially in a Korean film.
Well, sometimes they have happy endings. And at number 10 is Transcendence. That's the Johnny Depp film, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's at $75 million worldwide. That's not looking good for that. So that's the box office around the world. Godzilla did very well in 3D. There's a couple release date announcements. I love these. The J.K. Rowling Project, the spinoff of Harry Potter. It's a prequel, in a way. It takes place 70 years before the Harry Potter films. It's called Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. It has a release date. Thank God.
Are you sure she didn't wait? Are you sure she did not steal that title from, like, Maurice Sendak?
As far as I know, she didn't.
It's just, I'm joking.
If she did, it was an homage.
Yes, I'm joking. It sounds like a, you know, a children's book, which it probably will be.
Well, it was a book. It was one of the, it was a tiny little spinoff. It was like a little paperback book. There was one about the rules of Quidditch or Quidditch through the years, something like that. And the other one was this faux book by this guy who talked about Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
I'm just showing my lack of Harry Potter knowledge.
And they have taken this thin little, it was done for charity, both those little books. They were tiny little paperbacks. And they spun this off and have elaborated a whole series. And they're going to have three films, they think. The first one comes out November 18th, 2016. That's when it comes out. Well, there you go. I can't wait. It's terrific. It's coming out in 2.5 years. They've got a title and they've got a release date. Now, all they need is a director, some actors, a producer, and a script.
And they only have to do it in 18 months.
And this isn't, 2.5 years.
Oh, I'm sorry. I totally forgot what year we were in.
But still, with a movie like this and you want to do three films and it's a big franchise and you don't want to mess it up and they're building off Harry Potter where they expect this movie to make $800 million, you know, that's their goal. That's what the Harry Potter films all made. But you think about this. This sounds like the goofiest thing possible, right? Announcing a release date and you don't even have a director, a star, and a producer, a script.
They've got a title.
They fall?
You know what? They've got a title, and I bet you that they could just – they'll start announcing things like, we're going to release a movie. So I will just call it a big movie, the big movie, the big movie with no name. That's what we'll call it. We'll call it the big movie with no name, and we'll just pick a date.
That's right. The Hello Universal.
Oh.
They have a movie coming out Friday, November 4th, 2016. What is the movie? What's it about? What's it based on? What's its title? We don't know. It's a secret.
That's right. It's called Untitled 2016 Event Project. And what I love about that title is it literally says it would be like if the 57 Chevy, you know, if Chevy had this project in the 50s in its plant, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to, you know, basically they're putting fins on something.
But they say it's not a sequel. It's not a reboot. It's not a remake. It is a brand new, standalone, exciting movie.
And it's going to be an event because, gosh darn it, we're going to make it an event come hell or high water.
And most of their other movies, of course, are not events.
Yeah. I don't know where I was going with my Chevy reference there. But
I don't know either. Yeah. But I did just read a really good young adult novel called The Spark in the Engine about a young guy who works for a mechanic in a gas station in the early 1980s. It's terrific. Check it out, The Spark in the Engine.
Okay, so just because I went down a tributary that had absolutely nothing to do, well, I see what you're doing.
I tried to pull it back and make it worthwhile, make it pertinent. Okay. But isn't this fast? They've announced a movie. It's sort of like the Woody Allen. They always had Woody Allen Fall Project. Every year you would see that. He was always filming. He'd always film a movie every year. It had no title. Woody's making a movie. And now we're going to have an event film. We're not going to tell you what it is, what it's called, but we got a release date.
It may have pirates. It may be in space. It may.
Oh my God! Pirates in space.
Have a princess. We're not sure.
All right. So that's the world of Hollywood. Let's go to the world of Cannes, where
which is all about Hollywood in ways.
No, it's more about great films.
I know. Actually,
get excited by films that are actually really good.
Right, and quite honestly, one of the reasons I love coming here is because it's not Hollywood. Even though they bring some Hollywood in with Nicole Kidman showing up the first day to...
And DreamWorks.
I think, yes, they were. And I think I RSVP'd to something and then couldn't go to some... Yeah, I think it was a 1994, so 2014. That would be 20 years. But they were here with How to Train Your Dragon 2. I did not go see it. It was not 3D. They handed out the 3D glasses to everybody.
It got nice reviews.
Okay, yes. I heard it got, it was quite good. And they, you know, they brought everybody in and marched them up the red carpet there. And speaking of bringing people in and marching them up the red carpet, we're talking about Hollywood here in Cannes, and we may as well dispense with that early on. Some films, they're not in the official competition, or
most films
aren't, but I mean they're not official selections of either En Sainte en Regard or
right.
So Expendables 3 is here. They actually spent 9 months trying to bring a tank into Cannes, and they did. They marched the tank down the Croisette, and there's Harrison Ford and Sylvester Stallone, and I can't remember all the people that were
Why
on
did it take 9 months?
Because they had to, like, you know...
To drive it there?
No, not to drive it, but they had to demilitarize it, and they had to make sure certain... Right. You know, it's a big thing.
So it's a publicity stunt to launch the film, gain attention while at Cannes.
Yes. One year, they threw... I think I was with you. They threw Jerry Seinfeld off the roof of the Carlton for the bee movie.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, he was dressed as a bee.
Yeah, there's always these sort of stunts, but the movies that really get you excited, the things that really get you talking, are actually great films. There's been a couple big movies that have opened up that I'm excited to see. One is the Mike Leigh film about Turner, the great British painter. It's called Mr. Turner. It sounds like it got good reviews. How was it?
You know, it's a fine film. I wish I could understand it. It was beautifully shot by Mike Leigh and his cinematographer, whose name I cannot recall. However, I couldn't understand a single word. It needs subtitles. And it was, at one point, Timothy Spall, who plays, Mr. Turner. He plays the title character, who is a renowned painter that we all know and love. He was grunting, and I thought, oh my gosh, he's like doing his impersonation of Billy Bob Thornton in Sling Blade. Like, he was grunting his way through the movie.
Did other people have this problem?
Everybody had this problem. And they would tell you so. Now, mind you, a part of it might be the sound in the Grand Theater Lumiere, which this year is not as pristine as it has been in past years.
Ooh, that's supposed to be the premier location for film in the world.
Yes.
You know, if anywhere the sound should be good, it's in the Lumiere. The cinematographer was Dick Pope on Mr.
Okay,
Turner.
Yes.
That's certainly a film we'll be hearing about towards the end of the year. So is the movie that opened today, debuted today at Cannes, The Foxcatcher.
Yes, Foxcatcher. Now, this was a movie that was supposed to open at the end of 2013. They pushed it back. It winds up here in Cannes. It stars Steve Carell in a very serious role, in a role you would never think of him for. And Channing Tatum, Carell is recognizable barely. Channing Tatum, almost unrecognizable. I mean, and
is he fat?
He's just really buff and built and just, you know, cauliflower ears and big
kidding?
Nose. And yeah, it's, I mean, if I didn't know it was him throughout the whole movie because I didn't realize he was cast. And I forgot that he was cast in this.
What do you mean he's unrecognizable? Because he's fit. When has he ever been fit?
No, I mean, they had prosthetics on him and you know.
Really?
Yes. So, I mean, and the way
it looks like Channing Tatum.
Oh, really? Okay. So, yeah, I'm not a big Channing Tatum follower, so I'm not a.
It looks just like him.
Okay. Well, what do you know? I mean, come on.
A little more thuggish, perhaps.
Yes, exactly.
His ears don't look that mashed up. That's one way you can tell a wrestler. It's a film set in the world of Olympic wrestling, right?
Yes. Olympic wrestling in the 1980s, and it's based on a true story.
Yeah.
As you mentioned.
About a wealthy, wealthy man sort of sponsoring Olympic wrestlers.
Yes. And why?
I try to do that, and I just get in trouble.
Well, I'm not going to go there. And you know what? Those are some of the undertones in the film. Never discussed. Sexuality is never discussed. And yet.
Always present.
And yet always present somehow. And not even discussed or implied. It's not even a remotely, and yet it's left to the audience to figure out. In fact, I would say a lot of the films here this year in Cannes, the way they're narratively structured, they're leaving a lot to the audience to work out. They're not necessarily.
Sounds like a Cannes film.
Yeah, they're disjointed. And I don't mean that in a negative way. They just aren't told in a linear fashion. You know, they happen today and the future and the past and you then figure it out. One such film is Timbuktu, which is by Abderrahim Sissako. It was the first film to screen in competition here after Grace of Monaco, which screened out of competition. Grace of Monaco being the Olivier Dahan film starring Nicole Kidman as the Princess.
Who cares? It's a flop. It's an opening night film. It's not supposed to be good. It wasn't good. That's what always happens. The opening film is usually crap. It was this year, but she got to be glamorous and walk up the red carpet. And people said, oh my God, it's critical flop. What a disaster for Cannes. It's like the opening night film almost never is good.
That's
so
correct.
What are you talking about?
So then we went from that to Timbuktu.
Which is a noble African film about a terrible tragedy in Nigeria.
No,
I'm sorry.
In Mali.
Not Nigeria. Oh, in Mali. I beg your pardon.
Yes. And it kind of is based on true events. And
So it's awfully timely given what's happening in Nigeria, which is what I was trying to say.
Yes,
terrible situation about religious fundamentalists and a nightmare existence.
Yes. They basically take over a town. No music, no dancing, no sports.
Oh, my God. It's Footloose.
Yes. Except in this case, it's
real.
In Africa. Beautiful sand dunes. I mean, Lawrence of Arabia. David Lean would have been jealous of some of these shots and some of these locations. Beautifully shot. A little, you know, like many African films, the pacing is a little awkward.
But you make it sound like it's not a good film, but it's such an important topic that they'll give it an award.
It is a good film.
It is a good.
Yes.
Is it one of your best of the year?
I can't say that. We're in May.
It's certain. Well, I can absolutely do that. You see a film, you say, this is going to be my best of the year list. This is a great film. I don't care how many movies are on my list, whether there's 5 or 50, this is going to be on it because it's a great movie. It's not like you can only have 10 films. If there's 12 great films, you list 12. If there's 8, there's 8. Will it be on your list? Is it probably likely to be one of your best films of the year?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it was certainly liked by the European critics. People can go to Le Film Français. We'll include a link in our show notes and see what the European critics are saying about the movies at Cannes because the dailies have usually a rundown of critics. They choose like 8 critics from top papers. There's Film Internet. What's the Screen Daily? They do it too, right?
Yes. And IndieWire does it as well. They have Critic IndieWire.
IndieWire doesn't do it till after the festival is over. They don't get a lot of info during the festival.
Correct.
But during the festival, you can see a rundown day by day as movies come out. You can see Timbuktu has 4 top ratings. So does Winter Sleep.
Yes.
The film by
Nuri Bilge Ceylan. I've learned how to pronounce his name properly.
Wow, I've always said it wrong. Nuri Bilge Ceylan.
Yes.
And he is from?
He is from Turkey. And his last movie was Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, a movie that just felt unbearably long. And
I loved it. It was one of my favorite films of the year.
And yet, Everybody says that. And, you know, his movies are tough slogs at times. They are very...
Well, yes, you blew the lid off this, Sperling. His movies are talky and slow. Yes, of course they are. That's what they are. These are not films for general audiences. These are cineast films. They're pure festival films. They play in theaters. People love them. They will be watched for many years to come. You know, he's building up a very distinctive body of work, but they're not crowd pleasers.
Yes, and this one is very Chekhovian, or Chekhovian, you know, Chekhov.
Do they chop down the cherry orchard? How is it Chekhovian?
No, just the talking and the family relations and the house and the, you know, they're basically, it focuses on a retired actor who is now living in, oh my goodness, I can't remember the name of the town, but it's a very...
It's a resort town.
It's a resort town with cave houses. The houses are kind of like in caves.
Come again?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Beautiful. It's they're Anatolia.
They're in caves?
Well, yeah, they're cave. Yeah, I mean, they're in the
steps.
You mean
like you're in a cave and then there's an entranceway? Like it's literally a cave in the side of a hill?
Yes.
Okay. How
yes.
odd.
Yes, and beautiful scenery in the beginning, but then he goes inside and you never see it again. And then it's, you know, arguments and arguments. There's one scene that's 25 minutes long, or at least it feels that way, just between brother and sister. They're arguing. You kind of forget even what they're arguing about, because if you don't have Olympic subtitle reading skills, you are definitely going to get lost.
Are they talking so fast?
They're talking so fast. There is so much dialogue. They're yelling and screaming at one another. And you know, 20 minutes into it, you're like, wait, what are they arguing about again?
You need to work on your reading skills, Berlin.
No, I'm not the only one saying this.
You need to take an Evelyn Wood speed reading course.
But it's one of those movies. You want to know what Cannes is like? This is a Turkish film. Ceylan has had a couple of movies here. Klimat was a very well-loved film that he made. Three Monkeys, I think it was 2006 that the film appeared here, did very well. Everybody liked it. It had a bit of a plot, right? Then Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, 2011. People really loved it, even though for two-thirds of the movie, you're basically in a car with
driving somewhere.
Yeah, in the dark, looking for a dead body that you basically never... Well, no, I don't want to tell you what happens. But then what I have found with his films is they're very difficult, and as you say, not for the general audience. They screened this film at 3 in the afternoon. That was the...
Oh, that was nice.
Yes, because it's 3 hours and 15 minutes long.
Well, that was good, because... They have movies, for people who don't know, the press screenings take place in the morning typically, and sometimes the afternoon, all day long, really. But the big movies often are aired first thing in the morning at the Lumiere, and then they're shown with the general audience and people in tuxedos and the glamour and the excitement that same night. So what happens is we all see Mr. Turner in the morning, and then in the evening, Mike Lee and his stars show up, and they have the big premiere, and the audience sees it. So you've got the critics in the morning and the audience at night. Now, the screening's all day long. But big movies often get shown in the morning or 11, you know, 7, 8 a.m., 8:30 a.m., and then there's other screens at 11 and in the afternoon and the evening. But the big movies are often in the early in the morning. So if you had to see that at 8 a.m., it would really be tough going.
Well, and this was at 3 o'clock, not only for the press, but also it was the premiere. So Ceylan
was
there.
Yeah, that happens too. So was
so,
it was
so
full.
Wait, let me get to the point here. So I show up 45 minutes early, you know?
That's close. Well, yeah, but you got a pink badge.
Yes, I have a pink badge. And so
just good.
I'm standing there with the likes of Manola Dargis and some other big name critics. Mm-hmm. And they have stopped us. They being the gendarmes, the palace guards, the guards at the Palais des Festivals, where the event is held, because they want to let some of the cast and crew in and some of the people who have tickets. We stand there in the sun for about 45 minutes before they go, okay, I guess we can let these people in. By the time we get upstairs, of course, there are no seats left. They have closed all the doors to both the downstairs orchestra and the upstairs, and there are, like, you know, riots of people around every door in the balcony level, and you had people yelling, "I'm a white badge!" A white badge being one of the most important...
Even better, yeah.
Yeah, "I'm a white badge! I'm a white badge!" And people were pushing and shoving to get into this screening. Somehow, I managed to follow somebody in, somebody with a white badge, and I marched my way to a seat. Wonderful seat, wonderful. Couldn't believe I wound up getting it. Movie starts, hour into it, people were headed for the door.
that
right there, that's Cannes. And yet, what I would say about any Ceylan film, they can be tough to get through. But I have never been disappointed. I have never regretted getting all the way through, because they stay with you.
Well, so how's the feeling this year? Is it does it feel crowded? Does it feel normal? Does it feel sparse? What's the deal?
You know, because it's hard to judge an entire festival as one person because I spend a lot of days in dark rooms watching films, or writing, or working. So,
are you finding it harder to get into films or typical?
It's typical in that regard. It's somewhat typical. Here, I think that there are fewer journalists,
but they're not real journalists. A lot of these people are getting a journalism badge because they're market people, or they just want to get into the festival, or they're going to blog a little bit, but not a lot.
Yeah, I don't know how some of these people, because you and I both know some of these people who, and you think, how did this person? They're not even a journalist, and they're here with a journalist credential, which is a very good credential to have. And I know the press office does their best to kind of stay up on
top.
It's
got to be hard to stay on top of, you know, websites around the world in multiple languages.
Yes.
And which ones are valid and which ones aren't, and which ones have an audience and which ones don't. It's got to be hard, but you would think you'd have an easy, safe list of ones, approved websites that would always be first and foremost.
Yes, and I'm sure that Christina May, who runs the press office, and she has a new assistant named Celine, I'm sure they do, and I'm sure their job is not an envious one, and I would not necessarily want that as my job to try and figure out which paper in some country that, pick your country, is more important than another when you don't read the language or don't speak the language.
Yeah, can't be easy. Well, you've still got some exciting movies to come. You've got the Xavier Dolan film, Mommy. I'm looking forward to that. There's some other very interesting films. So we'll be checking in next week as you get towards the end of the festival.
Yes, and I guess, if we were going to mention any other films here, just going down my list of ones that I've seen, The Salvation, interesting Western, starring Mads Mikkelsen, Danish Western.
Oh, you didn't see the film with Robert Pattinson in it, though, did you?
This is Map of the Stars by David Cronenberg?
No, that's I think The Rover is the Robert Pattinson.
No, I did not see The Rover, which I believe you told me is getting good reviews.
Yes, yeah.
And I didn't see it. You always miss one or two.
You've seen like a dozen films already, easily.
Yeah, about 14 at this point, yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And the David Cronenberg is a scathing take on Hollywood. Oh, he's blown the lid off Hollywood.
Yes, good performance from Julianne Moore, but, it's very sterile, and like many of his films, like Cosmopolis was sterile, but not as sterile as Cosmopolis. He shot for a week in L.A., and then the rest of the film is shot in Toronto.
Are you going to put Oscar hopeful in the press material for Julianne Moore? Is she going to be up for an Oscar nomination?
I would not
do
that.
Flashy enough? No. Okay.
No, I would not. No. Amor Fu, Austrian film by Jessica Hausner. Very interesting film about, two people who, one man who is looking for somebody to commit suicide with. And it's a period piece, no less. So
he wants to commit suicide, but he's lonely.
Yes, precisely. I'm trying to think if there's anything. The Homesman, Tommy Lee Jones movie premiered here. It's a Western that focuses on a pioneer woman. Yes, it's not the kind of Western that you would expect. It's not Unforgiven or, a John Wayne Western. It twists and turns and takes all sorts of, it's a very unusual film, worth seeing.
And it's Hilary Swank's Once a Decade good performance.
That is correct. And she plays almost the same exact character that she plays in all of her films where she does a good performance. It's a strong woman.
Well, it's surely not like the person in Boys Don't Cry.
No, okay, fine. I was just going with a strong woman who is not considered attractive and, is kind of an outsider. Fine.
Yeah, she did that, and then she did Million Dollar Baby in 2004, and now in another decade, she's going to have The Homesman, another strong performance. She makes a lot of junk in between, but every once in a while, she pulls out a really good performance.
Yeah, and, I guess you asked me what it's like here. It's like it is every year. There's the international flavor of this festival is great. The films are definitely some of the best you'll see all year from countries all around the world, and that's what I love about it.
Cool. Well, back here in America, of course, we are the our God is television, not cinema.
Well, then you know what? I offer my condolences.
Why? Television is great. Everybody says that's where all the great artistic work is being done. When looking at mainstream Hollywood releases, you're seeing a lot of junk. The best you can say is, "Oh, Godzilla doesn't suck. It's okay," and that's a thrill.
Can't you thank me for throwing you that softball?
I appreciate that. And so, but in television, The artistic bar has been raised again and again and again, and they're doing it again at the upfronts. Now, why? What are the upfronts?
Well, that's when TV networks, who, you know, they all get together in New York, and they invite all these journalists and advertisers and people who they're trying to promote these new shows to, and they announce their fall schedules. Part of
they're
the problem
upfront
is
about how bad all the shows are going
to
be.
Yes, they're trying to sell all the advertising ahead of time. So they're saying, here's this new show. Don't you want to buy ads from now until the like February or March against this? And they'll sell out of some of their inventory on some of these shows. You know, I think $9 billion worth of advertising is sold during the next month. So specifically because of the upfronts, the problem is that it used to be you'd start a new season in the fall. It would end sometime around May. There'd be like a month of repeats, like usually in March or April, around Easter because people were traveling. And you know what? Now that is not the case. You're premiering new shows and new series all year long.
Why is that a problem?
Well, the problem is...
Does it make the upfronts less important? Is that what you're saying?
It makes the upfronts a little less important, but it's harder to sell, you know, advertising unless you have some kind of cycle. And when you don't have a cycle like this where you know...
Well, what do you...
When you don't have a schedule...
Well, you got a cycle. It's called 365 days a year. We got shows on in prime time. Sometimes they're reruns. A lot of times they're new. I mean, I don't understand. You're saying the fact that they don't go dark for 4 months a year is a problem?
No,
I would think
no,
be better,
not a problem.
There's more opportunities for new shows with new episodes to advertise on.
It just makes it a different way to monetize the shows and through right. advertising.
Okay. Well, TV is a year-round business. We know that now, but I think they all see the value in the fall TV season launch. They see the value in getting everybody's attention to focus on television for a few weeks in the fall. And I'm not talking about the upfronts where they talk to advertisers, but when they actually have their fall debuts, it's not like it used to be where every new show would debut in the same week. That was practically what happened in the old days.
Yes.
Nowadays, it's a little more scattered, but they do still benefit from that focus of saying, all right, everybody pay attention. Here are our big new shows of the fall. Here are some hints of the big shows that we're going to have in this winter or spring. Here's what some of our big plans are, our miniseries, our TV movies, these events. You know, pay attention. Television is back again. It never goes away anymore, but they really find value in saying, hey, let's get everybody in a room talking about TV. And so that's why, as far as a media thing, the fall TV season is still really important. But I will say, I've been hearing it my entire adult life. Oh, we're going to start programming year-round. All the networks say, oh, we're going to have shows in the summer. We're going to get rid of the fall season. We're going to get rid of mid-season. We're going to get rid of this. Then we're going to start casting and doing shows all year long. It's finally happened.
Yes.
It really has happened. I mean, cable came in and they ran new shows when the networks were in reruns. And that's where cable gained traction. The networks were dark. The cables put up new shows and everybody said, hey, something new to watch rather than a stupid rerun.
And that's how when the Fox network launched in the mid 80s, they started shows in April.
Exactly. And so that's been going on for a while. But now we have the big networks who still get a big chunk of the advertising and they are now really programming year round. The biggest hit of last year, it was not The Blacklist. It was Under the Dome, which CBS launched in the summer. That was the biggest hit of the year. The most eyeballs were watching Under the Dome, and they didn't move it to the fall or the spring. They kept it for the summer. It's coming back in summer of 2014.
And yet nobody in Los Angeles could watch it because, you know, basically Time Warner Cable had dropped CBS, which is where Under the Dome airs.
It didn't hurt the ratings.
It didn't hurt the ratings, that's for sure.
Right.
Just goes to show you how strong a show was
a big hit in the summer, like American Idol or Northern Exposure, you immediately move it into the fall or spring because that's where the big boys play. No more. And so you've got big shows all year round. You've got the networks are back into the miniseries game. They're not going to cede it to cable anymore. You've got complicated shows. You've got big budgets. You've got big movie stars, big talented actors and directors and writers, and they are making TV shows year round. My question, Sperling, is how are they going to pay for it?
Well, that's what I mean by monetize. I mean, part of the way that they would pay for all of this is they'd
reruns.
Reruns, yes, but
that's where networks made a lot of their money. The people who own the shows are the studios. The networks would pay money up front to watch a show.
It wasn't always that way, though. That started in 1996.
Started?
Yes. Because
are you talking about?
Previously it was you weren't allowed to be a network production company. Now you are allowed to be a network production company. You'd never see CBS Productions because you had to buy from
a
production
company.
No, but
I'm saying in the old days when a network paid for a show, they lost money on the first showing, but then they made money on the rerun.
Well, they would try to break even on the first showing.
Well, sure, yeah, right. But that's called losing money. You spend $1 million for a show, and you make back just $900,000 or $950,000 or $1 million. You're not making money. But then when they would show in a rerun, that was all gravy. But then they found out they can't do reruns anymore. So now they've got to pay more money to have more shows and more episodes year round, and they've lost the ability to make money during reruns. So the networks, in particular, are spending more money and not getting that, you know, gravy of the rerun anymore like they used to. So it's got to be a little bit harder to make money on the back end. Plus, of course, now they own the show. That makes it easier. Plus, they used to make money on DVDs, but that doesn't happen. But they can make money on subscription and streaming TV shows because everybody wants to catch up on 24 when the new season starts. So it gets really complicated, but
Well, there are also a couple of new trends that have been occurring. Well, they've been slowly evolving, I should say. One is that you start seeing these shows renewed, not just for a season, but they say – you got a two-season renewal. That kind of tells fans, okay, invest in this show because we're going to give you at least 2 years of this show.
That's right. You know it's going to be around. Plus, they can craft out storylines better. There's a lot of pluses to renewing for more than one season. There's also a lot of pluses to saying this is going to be your final season. I've been getting emails where it says fifth and, you know, this show renewed for fifth and. I'm like, oh, and final. That's what
the
final is.
Exactly.
It's going to be final. Fifth and. It's sometimes sixth. But it's more often fifth and final.
Yeah,
so,
but and you know what? If you're the actor, you're like fifth and the unemployment line.
So Two and a Half Men is renewed for their final season, 12th and final season. Cougar Town is on TBS. It
but
got
you know what? Let's
final.
Just, 1 second. 12th and final season. Remember Cheers? Remember how long that ran? 11 years. People were, wow, 11 years.
That's about cool. 6 years too long.
Yeah, that, wow, 11 years. That's huge. Now 12 years. And they're like, yeah, 12 years, whatever.
No, that's just a huge amount. It's one of the biggest commercial hits of all time. Not a good show. Cougar Town renewed for its final season. Parenthood got its sixth and final season renewal. You know, you can see a show like Parenthood especially. It's a serialized drama. They need to know the end is nigh. You know, in the old days, networks would just end a show. They didn't care. Yeah, so what if it ended midair? What do they care? Now they get to craft their final episode, decide what stories they want to end, what they want to leave hanging, what they want to do. They can do things they wouldn't do, like kill off characters or send them away because they know the show's about to end. It lets fans say goodbye, and it lets the networks promote it. So everybody wins.
Okay. Well, and I guess, are there any other trends that we should mention before? We're not going to go through all the shows that got canceled.
No, not at all. They can do that anywhere else. There's certainly a little more diversity in the fall on the big networks, not just black stars. We're seeing some shows put around Latino people, and they're more – it's always a battle, though. You know, you can talk about year to year. Then if most of them get canceled, then you find you're back to zero again. So it's always a battle to make the TV shows reflect the audience that is watching them. But I think – forget – the importance of it all. It's like, it's just good business sense when you've got a rising Hispanic Latino audience that you're going to want to put people in TV shows that they can identify with, shows starring them, not just the, you know, the neutered police officer, captain, boss in the background, but actually make them central to the show, make them important to the show, make them about those characters. People can identify with anyone. You know, I watched Sanford and Son when I was a little kid. What did I know about selling junk? but
I watched the Flintstones. What did I know about being a prehistoric caveman?
Exactly. So a great show is universal, like, of course, The Cosby Show being the crowning example. But you also want to have shows about every group that you have. If you got people out there in the world, it's going to make for a better and more interesting show. It's just a smart business move. And when you're talking about diversity, this is kind of shocking. Scandal, one of the big hits of television right now, Scandal. Got renewed for its second season, of course, last year. This is now going into its third year. Scandal was the first show, the first drama starring a black actor to be renewed since like 1974 make it into its second season.
Wait,
a drama.
Okay, so not a – okay, I did not know that.
A drama built around a black star. It was the first one in 30, 40 years. I mean, oh my God, that's embarrassing.
I had no idea that was the case.
I didn't either. I had not seen that fact. I think we got misled by the fact that so many great comedies like The Cosby Show and many others have been built around black stars. And drama, you didn't see it. And if they aired and they got on the air like James Earl Jones in Paris or whatever that show was called and other shows, they didn't last. So wow, that's a big step forward. And hopefully, just for the business sense, they'll be doing more of that. And of course, in that vein, Larry Wilmore will be hosting the roundtable called The Minority Report after The Daily Show.
Which we talked about last week.
Did we?
Yes, we did. Thank you for remembering.
I didn't think we did. Oh, well. So there you go. So, you know, the networks are making more shows, spending more money than ever. They're programming year-round like they never have before. They really are. And yet, Saturday night remains barren.
Yeah, I don't know what's – I mean, I think maybe that's catch-up time.
It's prime real estate. You've got beachfront property, and you're not doing anything with it. I don't get it. I never have. I never will. But how times change. American Idol was barely mentioned by Fox. Of course, they've been renewed for another season. I think all the judges will be back. Certainly Ryan Seacrest will be back. It's their number one show, and Fox couldn't mention it. They mentioned it like in passing. That's how much that star has fallen. Glee, which has fallen even harder. They're already talking about shortening the order for its finals. They renewed it for 2 years and they regret it. But it seemed like a dumb move at the time, so we're not second guessing them. It's not always a good idea to renew a show for 2 years. Glee was already fading when they renewed it for two more years. Now it's fallen off a cliff and they're talking about shortening its final season. So I think when it comes to Glee, it's a big whoop.
Oh, I see what you're talking about. You think that it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, guess what? It's about television, and it's about somebody getting renewed. In fact, late night couldn't
multiple be... Multiple seasons.
Yes, it could not be more competitive. But as the musical chairs take place at NBC and CBS, one name, as we talked about at the time, it was conspicuously out of the mix, and that was Conan O'Brien. It wasn't because he was unavailable. O'Brien's contract with TBS was apparently up for renewal. Well, the cable channel is sticking by him through 2018, and since they can't point to big ratings or big guest stars or buzz, they point to social media as the reason he's good for them. He's got 18 million digital fans, they say. 10 million on Twitter, 2.5 million on Facebook, a rather surprising 4.6 million on Google+. I mean, who knew that there were even 4.6 million people on Google+ and using it, and 1.6 million people on YouTube. Too bad none of that translates into this little tiny thing we call ratings. Conan has the youngest median age of any hour-long talker. Presumably Jon Stewart is younger, but his ratings this year average only about 862,000 viewers. That's Conan, not Jon Stewart. Are Conan's ratings a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? And is it what his contract was renewed through 2018. That's what we're talking about here. Big deal,
right.
Big whoop.
TBS has stood by him. They've renewed him. It's a big whoop. His ratings are live plus seven, by the way. Oh. So his 862,000 is only when you add in the people who watch the show tape delayed more than 3 days after it aired, which advertisers don't even care about. You rarely even hear about live plus seven ratings. So they had to go that far to get as big a number as possible. That is not a show that's really setting anybody on fire. Who cares if he's got 10 million fans on Twitter? You know, what does that mean? They're not watching. They added him on Twitter at one point and they've never gone back.
First, you had the live concert tied into theatrical release of the folky film Inside Llewyn Davis. Remember that?
I do.
Now, the teen weepy, I love that phrase, the teen weepy, The Fault in Our Stars, it is going to do the same thing. It's all about breaking through the clutter, that noise that you hear, and making your movie or book or album or whatever it is an event. So Fox is hosting a live concert via YouTube. It features artists on the soundtrack to their highly touted film, including Ed Sheeran, Group Love, and others, along with appearances of the film's stars and author, John Green. It all took place on May 14th. Thanks for the invitation, Fox. So that's in advance of the album hitting stores on May 19th. And the film is coming out on June 4th. Fans could watch the live streaming event, I guess is what it was, on the official movie website. And there are a lot of fans. Apparently, the book has sold millions of copies, and the fans made the film's official trailer the most liked trailer in YouTube history. I don't really know what that even means, but
it means the trailer for the movie got liked.
I know that, but I mean, you know, does that mean three times, four times? Okay, anyway, big deal or big whoop, Michael?
What do you mean three times, four times?
I'm kidding.
I don't get it. It's a big whoop, of course. It's just what you have to do now. I mean, Coldplay are releasing a new album. They did a couple elaborate things. They were like putting lyrics in books in libraries around the world. And people who found those lyrics in those books, they'd leave clues in their Twitter account, would get to go to a free concert. And it's just to gain attention, break through the clutter. So everybody's doing stuff like this. They're trying to think cleverly and make people pay attention to their event. You've got to really struggle hard and think like you can't just put an ad on Thursday night and think your job is done. You really have to come up with special, unique events to make whatever you're doing stand out. So
I've been writing about this. I've been writing about this on Celluloid Junkie for ages.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, now, the top editors of two of the world's most prestigious newspapers were unceremoniously dumped recently. Yes, this has been the talk at Cannes, let me tell you. Jill Abramson was booted from the New York Times, and Natalie, I cannot pronounce this name.
Natalie Nugeride.
She was dumped from France's Le Monde. You know, if you hear them yelling that outside the Palais. Oui. Well, she's no longer the editor. Both were repeatedly dismissed for their management style, and both were the first women to run those newspapers. And to be exact, Nugeride was the first to hold the title of director and editor-in-chief at the same time. Abramson was replaced by Dean Baquet, who is the first African-American to run the New York Times. He was over at the Los Angeles Times before that. France being France, the editor will be voted in and voted on by the staff rather than picked by management. However, they couldn't do that right away because the staff was on strike. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Is that true?
No, I just made that last part up.
There have been like five strikes right around Cannes. I mean,
there always are.
The airport people were on strike where you fly in for Cannes, and then the taxi cab guys who drive you from the airport to Cannes were also on strike.
Yes.
So even if you somehow flew in under your own power, you had no cab to get to the Palais.
I'm waiting for the luggage people to like figure this out and have them like they're going to strike in between the time that you get off the plane.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is a big deal. I mean, it's two of the biggest papers in the world. It's a change in management. The Times one seemed especially awkward as far as the way it was handled. It was ugly.
It was ugly. All right.
It's always ugly, I think, when a top person, you know, is forced out rather than, you know, retiring. So it's a big deal. You know, who runs these papers matters. The thing is, Jill Abramson did a great job. They're like, well, the paper's great. She's doing a great job, but she's a pain to work with. Well, guess what? That's what happens when you have strong, forceful people working at your company. You want a creative talent? I mean, you can't help feeling that it was, you know, they're of course fighting tooth and nail the idea that they're sexist. They deny heatedly that she was paid less than her male counterpart was paid when he was the last head of the New York Times. And they say, no, she's just a pain to work with.
Yes, well, normally they'd say, no, she just wants to spend more time with her family. They were like, she was a big pain in the neck.
Yeah, which again, you know, men who are pain and pushy are considered dynamic and strong. Women who are pushy are considered pushy.
Now, it's an annual tradition. Every year, families head to Disneyland theme park, mine included, like once or twice a year. And every year, they find it costs more to get inside. I can also concur, you know, it does cost more. Disney has raised prices there in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013. Wait, I see a trend. Now again, of course, in 2014, they have raised prices. Prices have gone up for a single day pass from $92 to $96. Parking went up from $16 to $17. And frankly, given where you have to park to go to Disneyland, they should pay you to park in any case. The same is true for their other Anaheim Park Adventureland, California Adventureland is what it's called. An annual pass to both with some restrictions, meaning you pay for it, but you can't ever come. That costs $519, which is up from $499. The not-so-magical $100 barrier will soon be passed, and analysts wonder about sticker shock finally kicking in. And what I would say to those analysts is, what do you mean finally kicking in? It's kicked in like a decade ago. The sticker shock on a single-day ticket to Disneyland, it's huge. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal because it's rising pretty fast. I mean, you look at it, it's like rising 4% a year for the past 4 years. Hasn't hurt attendance, though. They've been having about 16 million people at that park from 2009 to 2012. That's the most recent I have figures for. I don't have figures for 2013 yet. So they've been maintaining steadiness as far as who's coming to the park. Hasn't stopped you going from there, has it, Sperling?
No, I go about, and I said once or twice a year.
It's a great.
I go once like every 2 or 3 years.
I mean, it is a great day. I mean, you know, if it's $100 You're there in the morning. You're spending 8, 9, 10 hours there. It's not exactly not without value.
Yes,
you know?
Correct.
You know, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's going to really hit you in the head when it's $100, but I don't want to say it's worth it, but it's certainly not, you know, it's a luxury item, but it still feel like you're getting your value for it.
Now, this next story, I don't know what to say about it. Richard,
I love this.
Richard Linklater made one of his best films about a convicted killer. It was called Bernie. It was one of his best films. It starred Jack Black and Shirley MacLaine. And now the real life killer has been released from jail, but only if he promises to live in Linklater's garage. I don't know about that. It's one thing to make a movie about the guy. And anyway, turns out new evidence has arisen, presented by lawyers, of course, presented by I don't know what his name is, but Bernie Tide is his name.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't establish that he was innocent, but it does show he was sexually abused as a child and that the murder was triggered in part by the abusive treatment his lawyers say he received from the late Marjorie Nugent. Tide has already served 17 years, and if the killing was considered a crime of passion rather than one motivated by money, the maximum he might have served could be 20 years. Now he is released with the guarantee of receiving counseling for sexual abuse, and he will also be living with Linklater. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It's kind of crazy. This is just – it's a very good movie. You should see it. The funny thing is, in the film, which is a faux documentary in a way, there's actual interviews with real people who were involved in this. They're all, like, so supportive of Bernie. That was kind of one of the weird things. They're like, oh, but he was such a nice guy. Now that he's getting out – and people are kind of like turned against him, like, I don't know about this Bernie guy. Because they watched it, and when they saw the film, this is what IndieWire argues, they were reminded, oh, yeah, he actually killed somebody.
Yes.
And they're like, well, I don't know. He should stay in jail. So they can't seem to make up their mind. It's a very odd story. I think they got a documentary in the works, right? I mean, why not?
I think Richard Linklater should keep the cameras rolling.
Exactly.
Now, the Eurovision Song Contest has had political overtones for many years. Thanks to block voting and countries refusing to ever vote for singers from a country they are at odds with and so on. But this year's event, it took it to new heights. Russia in particular came in for a beating, with their name eliciting boos from the European crowd in attendance, and Ukraine using its votes to put Austria's entry over the top. This was Austria's second win.
They can't keep you out of the Crimean Sea, but by God, they can help somebody else win Eurovision.
That's right. So this is Austria's second win, apparently. They won back in 1966. You might recall, Michael, the big 1966 Austrian win for at the Eurovisions. The winning performer, Conchita Wurst, the drag queen persona of Tom Neuwirth. Yes, I'm not making any of this up. He appeared complete with a glamorous gown and a fully bearded face. So much for her passing. The song was Rise Like a Phoenix. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It'll be forgotten in a week. But it was kind of a crazy event. I mean, he's in the full beard. It actually was a pretty good song by Eurovision standards. I thought it was a good performance, and he has a good voice. So Austria's standing by him. They love him. They had a big, you know, event with like 10,000, 20,000 people showed up to cheer him on. And so many of them wearing fake beards in tribute to their winner. So Austria's excited, and our Russia's furious. They're like, look at that freak. So they get to look like the bad guy yet again.
On our last episode, we discussed the breaking news about Amazon's slow-selling publisher Hachette's Books on its website. New releases were allegedly being priced higher, and they were always out of stock or listed as taking weeks to deliver, rather than Amazon's usual, you know, overnight, you thought about buying it, so we sent it to you anyway kind of a deal. You know, that's the way Amazon handles everything else, at least. Now, the source of their attention is clear. Hachette is the first big publisher to be released from the Justice Department's binding on how they sold their books. Other publishers will follow every 6 months, but Hachette is soon likely to have the ability to negotiate terms without the threat of antitrust. You know, you might recall we reported on this quite a bit, and most of publishing is hoping they demand the same terms they had before, terms that won't allow Amazon to undersell competitors and drive independent bookstores and major competitors like Barnes & Noble or W.H. Smith, I think, in the UK, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, all of these publishers are concerned that all the other competitors will go out of business. At least, you know, they don't want to have that happen by selling books at a loss. On its side, Amazon is under some pressure from stockholders who, after years and years of patience, think it might be nice if Amazon showed some, you know, I don't know, profits, actually, rather than always investing in new markets. So this is a battle royale and a very visible one at that. Michael, big deal or big whoop, or should I just move on because it's a big deal?
It's a big deal. It absolutely is. Amazon and Hachette are fighting. Hachette is hopefully going to set the standard. Now that they're out of the overview of the government, they can renegotiate and demand and try and fight for the terms that they thought were a good idea for them and for the business as a whole. And whether they succeed or fail is going to affect how the other people do. And it just gets tighter and tighter. Samsung is, of course, one of the biggest tablet and smartphone makers in the world. They just ended their foray into ebooks. So Sony walked away like a year ago. Now Samsung has walked away. Now they just have an app on their phones and their tablets that's basically the Kindle app. So they've handed over their market to Amazon. You know, they've walked away. And so there's fewer and fewer players, and Amazon's getting bigger and bigger.
We've reported on the turmoil at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Man, we've done that in the past, right, Michael?
Yep.
Well, long story short, ticket sales are plunging, costs are rising, and the endowment is shrinking. That sounds like every opera company in the world. Opera has almost always lost money, but now something has to give. With about 16 unions involved in putting on an opera at the Met, not to mention the bureaucracy, everyone would like the something that has to give to be someone else's salary. Stagehands, performers, executives all seem to be waiting for someone, but not them, of course, to take a major cut. Recently, the musicians wore buttons during their performance, protesting the fact that management wants them to give up major concessions. They also voted to go on strike if negotiations fail. All the contracts face renewal this July, making Peter Gelb a happy man that his summer vacation will not be interrupted. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Again, like you say, this is operas all over the country and the world. What are they going to do? Are they going to be able to reach some grand agreement? I think somebody has to step up. Management has to say, we're taking a pay cut. We're not going to have 18 limos waiting for us and helicopters flying us to our weekend home. You know, how can you ask the stagehands? How can the actors ask the stagehands and the stagehands ask the management and the management ask the musicians and everyone ask everyone else to take a cut? There's not as much money to go into. They've all fought hard to have these salaries over the years. They all work hard and they all need to have a grand agreement where they all take a cut.
Yes, I would. That's ideally the way things would work out. Instead, I think they should riot like they did in... What year was the French Revolution anyway?
I can't remember.
Yeah, okay.
Which one? I know Les Mis was the one that didn't work.
Yes, exactly. At least according to the movie, which was based on a musical.
Which is based on a book.
Yes. Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And yikes.
There's so much going on. It's where we don't analyze some of the headlines. We just talk about all the things we can't talk about because so much is happening.
I don't even know. This is like one of those things where I'm like, I don't know. You know, we're all screwed because the internet's, you know, at least in the U.S., is going to cease to exist the way that it does presently, which is open and net neutrality is going away.
Right. The FCC said, hey, here's a possibility. Maybe we should allow some limited stuff like people selling fast lanes, meaning allow some companies to charge people to let their product come through quicker than others. Maybe that's possible. Maybe we should do that. Let's talk about that. And the world is ending.
Well,
it's called open internet or net neutrality.
Right.
And they said, well, let's put it up for discussion. So now for the next 6 months or so, everybody will be fighting and arguing. I've been getting emails, sign this petition about the open internet, about net neutrality, about what they're doing, how it's going to be great for business or destroy the world as we know it. Yeah, what's going on, Sperling?
Have you talked to any politician or anybody in the media industry about SOPA or PIPA? These were the two laws that were proposed to stop the Online Piracy Act. That's what SOPA stood for. Protect Intellectual Property Act. You know,
they were business initiatives, and they were initiatives designed by major corporations that moved into a buzzsaw from the technology firms and people of the internet who rose up and said, no, that's not going to happen.
Right. And it was something that Washington had never witnessed before, like the speed at which basically that potential proposed legislation got just smacked down. And so when you mention it to them, they just have like, they're just, you know, they don't want to talk about it. It's a bad memory. Well, I have a feeling Tom Wheeler is either a political genius because this year,
that.
Well, this year, now mind you, Tom Wheeler, of course, used to be the head of the cable lobbying group and the head of the wireless carrier lobby group. So a lot of people feel he went into the position as the head of the FCC with an agenda. And it wasn't an agenda that was meant to regulate or legislate anything in favor of consumers. It was meant to help out all of his friends and cronies back in the cable industry and the wireless industry. So either that is the case, okay, or he's a political genius and he said, yeah, I'm not going to be the bad guy here. I'm going to bring this to the public and let the public start calling all these congressmen and all these politicians and all these legislators and bureaucrats and let them find out what it's like to try and propose this kind of policy. Because it's not, I mean, and you know what? It's actually happening.
I don't think that's his grand strategy. He's like, so he proposed it, and now he's going to trickily get it destroyed. No. Yeah, I think he was pushing for exactly what he thought should happen and was reasonable. He did not want to declare it a utility, and the courts then said, well, you can't do what you're doing unless you declare it utility, so go back to the drawing board.
And that was the Verizon case earlier this year.
And he's thrown up his hands and said, Right. And now he's hoping people will get angry and upset, and then they'll forget and move on, and that they can go in and institute the rules that they want anyway.
Right.
And Comcast says, we don't care what you do. We can sell fast lanes. Now, fast lanes, explain what that is.
That is basically prioritized traffic.
Right. So if I'm Netflix and I pay you money, you're going to make sure that my traffic gets treated well and that my videos don't buffer and slow down and fail.
Correct.
So if I'm a big company and I got a lot of traffic and I can pay you the premium, my videos are going to go through, which means a new company that might want to compete with Netflix that can't afford to pay for a fast lane is going to have crappier service potentially.
And maybe their videos. Or not even be able to start.
Well, they start and they just, you know, anything can start. You know, I'm in my home, I'm showing my home videos and they won't work. They won't buffer. Nobody will watch them because it'll take forever for them to load. So that people say, oh my God, big companies will not be on the same footing as small companies. That's a disastrous idea. And Comcast says, well, tough. Because we don't care how you define the net. We don't care how you define the open internet or net neutrality. What we're doing is legal. So we'll see you in court, I guess, is their argument. And they also say, by the way, usage caps are coming. They'll be here in 5 years at the most. So if you use a ton of internet, you're going to pay more for it.
Yeah, well, that's why they want to get us all hooked on streaming everything we can, because they realize that they are going
to make more money.
Yeah, they are going to be effectively a dumb pipe. And everybody knows, I don't think anybody would argue that the way we get media, the way we get television and music, it's changing. It's not going to be over a satellite dish. It's not going to be over a cable. Well, I guess it would be over a cable. But
yeah, it will be over a cable.
It's not going to be through cable linearly, so to speak. It's going to be via IP.
Well, cable television is not going away anytime soon, but certainly the growth in their business is to sell you high-speed internet. And of course, they charge you the most for the industrialized world and give you the worst service in North America. So thanks for that. But they're also saying, hey, we want all of you to consume media through streaming video and all this stuff. That's what everyone's pushing us towards. At the same time, they want to charge us more for the more internet bandwidth that we use.
Correct. Yes.
So if we do cancel our cable subscription, guess what? They'll get that extra $100 back by charging you for all the – and they say today, oh, well, don't worry about it because the bandwidth that you use, most people will pay the same amount.
Now, we're talking about – right. And we've talked about this on the episodes leading up to this one recently. And the only reason we're talking about it today is because the FCC finally met and the rules were finally – or the proposed rules were –
Put
out for discussion. Right. So that's why we're talking about it now. And while we're talking about it, in fact, cable subscription and satellite subscription, pay television subscriptions, at least in the U.S. and in some places around the world, are slowly declining. It's not, the sky isn't falling.
The number of people who have pay cable.
Right. Correct. It's slowly declining. Not, like I said, it's not... It's
like
not
a 1% decline.
Yeah,
it's the first time ever, though.
Yes, and it's been happening for a couple of years. It's a slow deflation. So that's why when AT&T, one of these ISPs, one of these internet service providers and a telecom, over the weekend announced that they would be buying DirecTV, a satellite programming provider, basically a cable company but without the cable, a satellite dish instead, they said they were going to be buying DirecTV for $48.5 billion. A lot of people went, But why? Why would you do that? Satellite is an obsolete technology. We're all going to be getting our content either wirelessly or via a coax cable. Why would you do that? or fiber. Why would you buy them? And it's really to get more clout. And as the New York Times pointed out.
Yeah, to get more clout, to get more market share, and have more negotiating power with the channels. I thought, oh, they're going to take DirecTV and make it an over the top service, meaning you'll get DirecTV via the internet. But what they were saying is, no, they're going to be turning their UVerse people into DirecTV customers. I don't get that. Maybe they just mean rebranding.
Well, yes, rebranding, but I think DirecTV has certain media deals in place and content deals in place and licensing deals in place
right. That
are more favorable than what AT&T has, because DirecTV has 18 million subscribers in Latin America. They have more subscribers in the U.S. than AT&T, so they probably got better terms. Therefore, AT&T subscribers will now be DirecTV subscribers, and DirecTV will grow bigger. And if you want to cut a deal with DirecTV and you want to get into basically a negotiation battle and you have a blackout, well, you might be losing a large chunk of your audience. And hey, Mr. Network Owner, how does that feel now that you don't have, 50% of your audience? Go tell your advertisers that you've just lost that.
So the FCC has put up these rules for discussion. Comcast says, we don't care what you call it. We're going to be able to charge for fast lanes. We'll see you in court. Plus, we're going to add usage caps in the next few years. AT&T is buying DirecTV. And while this is all happening, cable prices are going through the roof. Cable prices are rising four times faster than the rate of inflation. We're talking about from 1995 to 2013. So it's about a 20-year span, and cable prices are rising and increasing even when there is so-called competition, because their definition of competition is so lame, it doesn't really count as competition.
Yes, well, that was actually part of the FCC document, was they were kind of mentioning competition. Whether we'll actually see it in our lifetime is another story. But
and over on the side, while this is all happening, the FCC also announced they're going to be auctioning off broadcast airwaves and wireless spectrum, which is a huge deal, will affect all sorts of things, and it barely got any attention.
But, I think that's because everybody expected that, because the spectrum isn't being used. The FCC owns it, and they had planned to auction it off for quite some time. Everybody, it's one of those.
Okay.
Nobody mentioning it because everybody expected it. It's like, hey, we should do a story. The sun came up today. Well, yeah, everybody thought that was going to happen.
So next week, we'll do a separate 10-hour episode of Inside Baseball just to try and figure out what the hell's going on and what it means to you.
Well, part of the problem is that it's all happening so quickly. There is so much of it to discuss, and it's so detailed and technical at times that...
And you're in France.
And I'm in France, and that's part of the problem. Well, not that I'm in France. That's not a problem at all. In fact, I love France. And
how can we reach you while you're in France?
Well, you could email me, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Michael will also get that email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also, call and leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is our number. That's 888-567-7263. Now, what we really urge you to do is subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher.
And rate it.
Rate it and review it. Go to anywhere they give podcasts away for free. And you'll be able to, subscribe to the show. We actually appreciate it when you do. You can find that information, the ways to contact us, ways to follow us on Twitter. At Showbiz Sandbox is our username. We're on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page will show up, as well as links to all of the stories that we've discussed on today's show. All of this information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It changes every once in a while. What is it this week, Michael?
I'm still not in con.com.
Okay, or, if you have some trouble finding Michael's writing about the entertainment business and entertainment in general, on that particular website, try michaelgiltz.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.